So as we move into this month of Eightfold Path, so I know Steve Wilhelm gave a talk on wise livelihood last week. And so just to quickly review, if you're kind of unfamiliar, Four Noble Truths are the foundational teachings of the Buddha. So there is dukkha, there's this experience of suffering, there's an origination of that dukkha, there's a cessation of that dukkha, and then there's the path leading to the end of that. So those are the Four Noble Truths. The last Noble Truth is also the Eightfold Path. So we've been taking this whole year to really dive deeply and have a sustained attention around it, both here on Monday nights and the Sunday mornings and Thursdays and all the different meetings. So there's a chance to really kind of get some purchase on it. Now, if you look at the Eightfold Path, the eight sections, there's basically three sections. There's a section on with wisdom, kind of our earnest understanding with wise view, wise intention. Then there's a middle section, which is right speech or wise speech, wise action, and then wise livelihood. So that's right where we are now. And then we go into all the stuff we're usually used to as meditators, the wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. So they all work together. They all support each other. Our meditation practice helps develop our wisdom, which helps us come into the life more fully and more ethically. Now, one way to look at this middle section before I get into the specifics of wise livelihood, it helps to cool things down, helps our minds to start to become less turbulent, helps things become more quiet inside. On the retreat I just taught with Narayan, she used this analogy of mud. And if we just let the mud settle, it starts to clarify on its own. But if we're always stirring it up, it gets suspended. And the stirring up is off, one way it does it is when we're being unethical. When we're acting in a way that's causing harm, we're coming out of greed and hatred and delusion. That tends to make a lot of internal turbulence. Just notice this for yourself. Next time you tell a lie, how quiet is your mind? How quiet is your body? You're like a little like, hope they don't catch me. If you take something you know you're not supposed to take, it's not a peaceful experience usually. There's a lot of little anxiety that comes up. There's that worry. You're trying to justify it. So all this kind of churns us up. So this middle section, one of the reasons it helps is it helps to quiet down this internal static and internal noise. Because we become As we act in a way that's based in non-harm, in kindness, in generosity, we start to act in a way that's has integrity. One way to define integrity is a sense of wholeness, right? That sense of wholeness of being. So we become more integrated. We become more just what we really are. So that's one way we can look at that. And it's a very helpful way that we'll explore a little bit tonight around wise view or wise livelihood, I should say. But another way we can look at the Eightfold Path, and especially this ethical piece, these three sections of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, it's a way for us to actually demonstrate and manifest our practice, to actually prove our practice, to actually show up. Basically put our money where our mouth is, to actually engage in a way that expresses our wisdom and our understanding. Because how we speak, how we act, and how we make a living, these are really essential ways of integrating our practice. Because if our practice was something just confined to our sitting practice, or confined to our book study, or confined to going on retreat, and we just forgot about it the rest of the time, it would have very limited value. But as lay practitioners, we get a chance to try it out in our relationships, in the way we speak to dear ones and to people we don't know or people we don't like. How do we actually show up in that? How do we actually act? And then tonight, how do we make a living? I know some of us, I don't know what percentage is right now, but some of us don't work, or whether we're retired, or we stay at home, or work inside the home, or we're raising children, or we can't work for whatever other reason. We can think of work as just how we use our time, kind of our bulk of our time, our energy, whether it's volunteering, caring for others, doing hobbies, all these different things. So we'll kind of make wise livelihood fit everybody. if we can. So I want to explore both of these elements of both the way that our ethical behavior likes to quiet things down, and also how we can use this as a way of manifesting or demonstrating, testing out our practice. How does our practice show up? So wise livelihood. So again, we can expand it to include whether you're a parent, a grandparent, if you're unemployed, not working, retired, still find a way to make this fit. How do I actually show up in the world? Now, wise livelihood is one of those topics that sometimes ties us in knots, right? Because is my livelihood wise enough? Is it right enough? Am I causing harm? Am I, doing things in a way that, could I make it better? And often it causes a lot of internal stress around that, a lot of internal difficulty. Because we create this really high bar in our heads. I think we conflate a spiritual life with a spiritual work, right? And that's, some of us have that luxury or that privilege, and some of us don't. But we can always bring the spirituality into our lives in a very concrete and beautiful way. Now, most work is kind of a mixture, right? A mixture of what's good and what's not so good, or not always 100% helpful. Some of it has some harm in it. Now, the Buddha, as he often would do when he was talking about these kind of things, he would kind of set an example what not to do versus more what to do. I mean, he did a lot of that, but more around how do we live. And the bar he set, in some ways was fairly low, especially compared to what our minds take it to be. In a collection of suttas, he says this. He says, monks, a lay follower should not engage in five types of business. Which five? Business in weapons, business in human beings, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poison. These are the five types that a lay follower should not engage in. Right? So this is pretty clear, these five areas. Because really these five things I just mentioned have harm as kind of the primary thing that they're doing. The primary focus is around causing harm. So there's certainly wealth. How can we establish wealth and gain wealth legally, not illegally? Peacefully, without coercion or violence, honestly, by not trickery or deceit, not causing harm and suffering for others. Basically, if you ever watched the show The Sopranos, none of that stuff would count for this wise view. All that is kind of outside of this. So if you happen to be in one of those situations, it just bringing consciousness to it, just being awareness, like, oh, okay, this action I'm doing, this way I'm making a living, is clearly causing harm. It's really designed to do that, and I'm benefiting from that. So let's look into these five a little bit more, even though they're fairly clear. So business and weapons, right? So if we're an arms dealer, if we're selling guns, those kind of things, those obviously have the potential for causing tremendous harm. I mean, you can look at how many school shootings there are in this nation. It's just how many mass shootings there are is just staggering. Business and human beings. So this is talking about slavery, prostitution, trafficking. So these are very obvious things, but yet, unfortunately, they still exist in this world. Even in this first world country, they're still a huge issue. Now, business and meat. So this is around the sense of raising animals for slaughter or being actually killing them. That goes into this line of you're clearly causing harm. So I'm not making a comment about whether you should be vegetarian or not, but just in terms of actually killing an animal. And each one of these, we could talk about different exceptions or ways. Like, let's say you like to hunt or like to fish. How does that fit in with this? I think if it's not your primary occupation, then, maybe the Buddha would say, that's okay. businesses' intoxications. You know, so if you're selling alcohol or other drugs that cause people to lose their clarity, to cause a sense of heedlessness and the harm that comes from that. And finally, business in poisons. So if you're developing poisons to kill creatures, you know, it's a pretty clear, everything you're doing is designed to cause harm. So these five areas, I think, are pretty obvious. There's a direct or potential harm that's from them. And I think as lay practitioners, again, don't get too focused, too hung up on making sure your livelihood is completely harm-free, right? Because, you know, I taught a retreat for 7 days or 6 days. It seemed like, okay, that was no harm. But, you know, I was driving down the freeway, contributing to global warming. You know, who knows how many bugs I hit on the freeway. You know, it's hard to be 100%. So give yourself some space around that. It doesn't have to be a spiritual in focus, as I mentioned. I think sometimes we conflate this spirituality, having a spiritual focus of our work, that's the only kind of wise livelihood. And that's not true. There's so many ways that we need to contribute to our society, to the world, that you're not necessarily you're spiritual. But yet we can be spiritual while we're doing them. We can actually bring that into the very day-to-day. And that's the second thing I want to explore tonight, is how to make our livelihood really an expression of our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, for instance. And this is in terms of integrating our life into our practice. And I think this is such a critical piece for all of us, is how do we take these teachings that sometimes may seem really archaic and abstract, you know, the Four Noble Truths, that there's dukkha and there's origination of dukkha. How does that relate to me doing my job? How does it relate to my relationships? So we have to do this act of translating it so it actually seems real and alive for us in the ways we interact, the ways we show up in the world. So one way to do this is to kind of develop a central thread. So for those who are on the retreat with me, I see a lot of you here. I use this in the closing talk, so forgive the duplication. Because leaving a retreat, you know, we learn a lot, and it's very immediate learning, and we often wonder, how do I bring this home? How do I take this home? And sometimes we want to capture that stillness or that quality of a moment-by-moment mindfulness, but our lives are so turbulent, so busy. But what we can do is take something that we learned that really touched us on a retreat, or if just in our lives in general, as we listen to the Dharma, what really catches your ear? What actually makes you perk up and listen? What seems to have a level of engagement that's just naturally for you? What am I really concerned about? What am I really interested in? What am I passionate about understanding more about? This is a great thing to make as a central thread that we can focus on. Something that's fresh for us and alive for us around practice. So this is something that may change over time, may change, you know, month to month or even week to week, but finding something that really grips you. Maybe there's tonight's talk or a talk that you heard a few months ago. That's something that really landed. So kind of simplifying all this down to something you can actually take a hold of. This poem called The Way It Is by William Stafford points to this. So William Stafford wrote this, I believe, 30 days before he passed. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Right? So that's one of our kind of primary tasks, if you will, or imperatives as lay practitioners is to find that thread in our own practice, to find what really grabs us, what really we can feel hold of. Because it can be hard in the midst of an interaction or busyness of life to reflect on, okay, which of the Four Noble Truths should I be working right now? Is this really dukkha or more the origination of dukkha? Or which of the Eightfold Path? Or which of the cycle of the dependent origination? There's 12 links, you know. Okay, maybe that one is the right one. It becomes a little too abstract. But if we can take the Dharma and find an entry point, that's really what's needed. Ideally, one that has a kind of a clear felt sense of it, felt sense when I'm aligned with it, when I'm connected to it, and also when I'm off of it. You know, felt sense is that inner sense that, okay, it is a somatic, a visceral sense of connection with, right? This is one of the key things that help us transform. There's also clear feedback, whether we're aligned with it or not. We can tell that in the moment. Okay, I'm lined up or not. So it has to be fairly simple, has to be fairly clear. And this involves some translation and paraphrasing at the traditional teachings. Right? So I love to hear students, sometimes they find a way that really lands for them, that really makes sense. I'm trying to think of a recent example of that. And as you share that, and that's one of the benefits of having a Sangha, is that people can share what else is alive for them, what connects with them. And that helps inspire other people to find their own connection. So I want to offer three that I sometimes work with. And again, these may lose their freshness, but I can find a new one or find what comes alive. The first one is simply, am I connected with my heart? Do I feel that sense of connection with my heart before I'm speaking, before I'm acting in this moment, through the way I'm relating to the world? Versus, is my heart contracted? Is it guarded? Is it relaxed and open, or is it contracted and stuck? So this one helps me connect with kindness. It helps me connect with non-harm, connects with truthfulness. And this can be a lovely kind of way of going through life. You know, can I meet this interaction from a place of my heart? Can I touch into my heart before I speak, before I connect? Or if I feel, you know, maybe triggered, I feel defensive, I feel hurt, can I learn to tend to that and have compassion for that pain instead of maybe acting from that pain? And this is where all the kind of shoulds that we get tripped over, and we have to be aware of, because it's easy to say, okay, I should only have an open heart. But when my heart's closed and I'm feeling pain, I'm feeling judged, I'm feeling criticized, then I just criticize that more because my heart's not open, right? Can I have some openness to the fact that I'm suffering in this moment? Can I have some kindness toward the pain that's there, right? So we can learn to care for that. And this is, of course, a very rich practice interpersonally, you know, with our work, with our customers, with our coworkers, with our supervisors and bosses. How do we actually show up with a kind heart? And it's nice because you can do it very covertly. You don't have to proclaim that you're practicing some Buddhist thing. You're just being kind. You're just coming, you're connecting with your heart. You're seeing, am I resonating before I speak, before I act in this moment? And of course, this extends not only to those you interact with, but also toward yourself. You know, probably there's more people who have a trouble with overworking than underworking, I would imagine. Probably many people tend to overdo it, you know, stretch themselves too thin, keep saying yes when maybe they should say no, to have more clear boundaries around their time. You know, so this extends inward also. Just like the teachings of the metta phrases, you know, we offer them to different categories of being. And one of the points of that is to realize that all these beings, including yourself, are equal, equally deserving of metta, equally deserving of kindness. So connecting with the heart, you know, whether it's in the chest or the solar plexus, what does that actually feel like when my heart's connected and when it's not? And not to judge the fact when my heart isn't connected, but learn to turn toward it with compassion, with curiosity. So that one, I mean, I hope you start to see how that, even just one of these, becomes this gateway into the whole array of the Dharma, right? To really come into the Dharma. It's been said, I think in the Zen tradition, that the Dharma gates are endless, you know, and I vow to enter them all. But really, we just have to enter one. We just have one that allows us to get a foothold, and then from there start to deepen around our practice, to deepen on our understanding. And another one is truthfulness. You know, can I speak from a place of truthfulness, of not falsehood? So, of course, this is one of the precepts. It's also one of the Eightfold Path. It's a big Buddhist said, okay, this is deserving of a whole path factor of wise speech. Now, truthfulness is one of those ones which I think we can really dig into. Like for myself, sometimes I find myself telling little lies just out of convenience. Like I don't really want to go into the details. You know, how are you? You know, my dog just died. My dog's fine, but listen, my dog just died, and I'm not going to necessarily share that with everybody. I might just say, I'm fine, you know, even though I may not be inside. You know, so that's, but this just sets up a little level of dissonance, of disconnection from what's true and what I'm speaking. Right? I think that's the key thing, is that dissonance. For those musicians out there, if you have these two strings, if you're doing a string instrument and they're not quite in tune, they vibrate. It's almost obnoxious when they're close, but not quite. It's really irritating to the system. So it's the same thing when things aren't quite true. A nice practice of that is to recognize it, to recognize that dissonance. That's why I so much emphasize body awareness as practitioners. You know, if body is a safe refuge or a safe enough refuge, I know sometimes it's not because of trauma and because of pain and patterns like that. But if you can connect, develop a relationship with the body, you can start to notice when things are quite lined up. Sometimes even before your mind recognizes it. You know, you're just saying something out of habit and you realize, okay, there's a little dissonance there. And I go back and check to see what I just said. And I try to correct it if I can. I try to make a more true statement. Of course, this truthfulness doesn't mean you always go around and share your truth about everybody else, right? Okay, let me tell you your truth. Or it's really my opinion about you, what I believe is true, what my ideas are you. Ajahn Chah would say that after he talked about the importance of truthfulness, he would hear about all these couples in the parking lot having these big fights, because one would say, okay, I want to tell you, honey, about here's something true about you, right? And that's not really what's meant. You know, it's about this, okay, how I have that sense of honesty that's not opinion, all right? Because really, if you think about what's really true in this moment, I mean, that's really, really true. The list gets pretty small, right? Because each one of us is interpreting this moment a little bit differently. Because each one of us had a different upbringing, a different family, different experiences, different culture. And we experience the moment a little differently, right? But we say, this is my experience is the truth versus just my experience. So simple way is just owning that. This is my sense of it, my understanding. Not this is the truth, this is the reality. So truthfulness, you know, comes into play, like in the work environment, how can I be truthful when people around me maybe aren't being so truthful? Or maybe the company itself is doing some things which aren't completely truthful. You know, it's hard to, that's part of where the integrity comes in and the choices we make as practitioners. And for most of it, it's not going to be 100%, right? Sometimes we have to choose our battles or choose which ones we're going to stand up for. But if there's a lot of a lot of dissonance, a lot of untruthfulness, maybe that's not a good place for us to work. You know, let's say look at parenting, you know, being with children. If that's our livelihood is really being with children and raising children, whether it's as a parent or a grandparent or a teacher, you know, how do we see what's appropriate? You know, how do we actually own that truth? I remember my daughter when she was, I don't know, 3 or 4 or something, asked me point blank, is there really a Santa Claus? Right? And we hadn't really like spread the myth, but we didn't, you know, discount it. But for some reason, she wanted to know. And I told her, no, you know, it's this something about the spirit of all that stuff, you know. But it's that sense of what's appropriate, you know, learning that nuances of that. And as the Buddha would talk about with truth or true speech, is that it has to be true, and it also has to be beneficial. And it also has to have the right timing. So it goes through those three gates before we speak. Truthfulness also is just how we show up in the world. Do we show up in a way that feels integrated, that feels in integrity, or do we kind of shade that a little bit? So again, this is not about giving you more things to judge about yourself. It's more a chance to understand yourself more fully. All these edges, please don't use it as a thing to say, oh yeah, I'm such a terrible meditator, I said that untrue thing. Use it as a chance to become curious. What was going on in this mind and body? You can tap into some of maybe the older pain that made that come out in that way and see if there's a way to repair it or find that pathway back to integrity. So just that simple one of truthfulness helps us align with what is. Some ways you could say that's one way of defining Dharma practice, is discovering and understanding what is. What's actually true? What's beyond our conditioning? What's beyond our opinions? Beyond our thoughts? Beyond the sense of self? What's actually true? What's actually true? And when we get to those deeper levels, there's not a lot of words we can say about it, but there, we can align with that resonance, that connection. Now, the final one I wanted to share, again, these are just options to think about, but the important thing is for you to find what resonates for yourself. And that's to work with not taking things so personally. Not to take things so personally, right? And this is something, if you think back to when you first, or even before you started to meditate, and now, you may notice that you naturally are taking things a little less personally. Sometimes a lot less personally. There's some, it's really fun in life to notice, well, in the past, that statement or that interaction would have just sent me through the roof. I've been so charged by it. And now it's like something is missing. It's like there's some gear that is no longer there, that I'm not running this script or this conditioning or this pattern of suffering. Something is falling away. And so in workplace, or however we're, you know, defining this wise livelihood, there's a train of identification, that sense of claiming this is I, me, and mine. This can be such rich territory. And so often we do need to really step in and say, okay, this is what I think we need to do. This is my opinion. This is my idea. This is my responsibility, my success, my failure. So there's a way that we step into that. But at the same time, we can also hold it lightly, not hold it as a really a self-defining thing. This is who and what I am. And this is also a very deep practice if we take that on. And so we start to notice, what is it like when I am taking things personally, when my sense of self is really forming around this interaction, around this success, around this criticism? Because work is, for most people, it's a combination of gain and loss, praise and blame. Even if we're really successful, we still sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes we get criticized. Sometimes we lose. Sometimes we fail. And if we're so invested in only having the positive sides, there's going to be suffering with that. Also, the more invested we are, the more identified we are, the less fluid we are with life, with changing circumstances, changing situations. You know, this applies so much with parenting and all these other ways we are in the world. Can we be less invested in any particular sense of me? And yet there's this thread, as William Stafford talked about, that seems to be continuous through all these different forms of me. So not taking it personally, this is one of those, just like all three of these, that we have to tread carefully with them, because it's easy to feel triggered and then get triggered with the fact that we're triggered, right? We start to judge the fact we're judging. You know, okay, I'm taking this so personally. Oh my God, why can't I take this personally? You know, and yet we're just getting tighter and tighter around it. And that's one of the kind of knacks that we hopefully develop. And this is maybe next month we start to go into this, is around wise effort. How am I relating to this? Is it a way that makes more suffering or less suffering? Is it making me more contracted, more identified, taking it more personally? Or is it allowing that to start to soften and loosen and become less established, less defined? Is one way we can define wise effort. So starting to see, you know, what's going on with that? Because this territory of taking it so personally, whether we're being defensive, feeling judged, feeling attacked, or we were really feeling judgmental ourselves or critical ourselves, it's such a rich territory to look at and to kind of step back and notice it as a process generically instead of the actual truth of who and what you are. Right? Because we still have to take responsibility. We still have to be a human. And sometimes we have to go back and care for these older, archaic wounding, maybe the trauma that we're still unresolved with, or maybe the pain of childhood or this past experience, to start to free up the present moment so it can be just how it is, free of our conditioning. So not taking it personally, not taking it so personally. So the invitation I'm offering is to find that thread, to find what's alive for you. And sometimes you're just like, well, I'm not really engaging with anything, right? Just kind of listen a little more closely. Maybe reflect on, why did you start to practice? You know, why are you spending all this time sitting around instead of doing something more productive, right? I mean, you could have, you know, this 2 hours, you could have watched a whole Netflix movie, you know? Or clean the garage or some other productive thing. So for each one of us, there's something that drew us to the practice, that engages us to the practice. Let that kind of be a question. Let that come to the foreground. And then seeing, how can I bring that into my life? How can I bring it into the way I work, the way I volunteer, the way I interact with others? And see if that doesn't grow and become more and more tangible. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle, and then we'll have a chance for any questions or sharing you might have. Thank you for your kind attention. So if there's any questions around wise livelihood, you know, both sides of it, the side of, you know, the harmful side of it, like kind of cleaning that up. Also the side of, how do I, you know, find that thread? How do I find that sense of connection? How do I breathe life into it? or any other Dharma questions are also perfectly welcome. So in the room, you can raise your physical hand, and we'll bring the mic around, and in online, you can just raise your virtual hand.
Just wondering, like, I guess, like the line between feedback and then taking that in and working on that, and also taking things too personally,
yes.
and not identifying with certain feedback that you get as well.
Yes, so feedback is one of those ones which is really tricky, right? Because it's, and sometimes I'm like, I don't really want to ask for any feedback because I'm not feeling up to it. But I think when it depends how it's done too, how it's received and how it's delivered. There's, when I went through my teacher training, we worked with feedback, and one way we did it in a really kind of formal way, is that we would imagine that the person that we're offering feedback is like they're already perfect. They just have a little bit of a smudge here, and we're kind of bringing some attention to that. So that's kind of in terms of the delivery. But in terms of receiving it, sometimes it does kind of prick, right? Sometimes it hurts because it's like, oh wow, I feel, you know, I thought I was doing better, or I feel, you know, judged, or I feel embarrassed, all those kind of qualities. One thing I think is helpful to do, and this is something I believe that Gurdjieff, you know, the Roman or the Russian mystic suggested, or maybe his father ever suggested it, that when you get feedback or someone tells you something, just say thank you. And then sleep on it, right? So you're not saying like, yeah, that's true, or I'm going to accept it, but you just kind of hold it for a while and then let it percolate. And then, because often the first reaction or first 5 or 10 reactions may be more these layers of defensiveness until finally like, oh yeah, they probably have a point there, or maybe that is something helpful to look at. So that's my best way of thinking of it, is even though it's some feedback may be hard to hear, so, okay, I'm going to thank them for doing that and then sit with it. And then after a day, you can come back and say, yeah, that fit, or not really, or you don't necessarily after that conversation, but just gives you some space around it. Because feedback often will, unless we're feeling really kind of centered in ourselves, often will kind of make us feel personal, personally attacked, or our deficiency, or all of these goes really deep. And so another way to work with it is I'm going to take that feedback and how it made me contract and make that an investigation. So what I mean by that is when I say investigation, it's not so much an intellectual thing, like I'm trying to map everything out. That sometimes is helpful. But I find the more powerful one is to just kind of sit with the actual experience of it. Okay, I've heard that feedback and I feel the tightness in my chest. I can feel my body want to kind of roll around and I want to kind of run away and hide. Okay, then I be with that. I just kind of hold that and experience with a compassion, with mindfulness. And I start to notice what's the kind of belief that got triggered. Okay, I'm not good enough. You know, I'm not going to be accepted. I don't belong. Whatever those kind of more tender things. And you be with that for a while. And you can see how the body reacts to that. And eventually you start to get down to the point where you see the belief is just a belief. It's not actually who and what you are. So it might take a few minutes, it might take a few years, depending on the tenderness of it.
Definitely, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. All right, so Karen, go ahead. See, let me see if I have to give you permission to unmute. Host is... Okay, you should be able to do it now. Actually, no, I just made it so you can't.
Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead. Yes.
You made a comment just right here at the end about finding the thread, but also it was right before then about winning and losing, a sense of winning and losing,
mm-hmm.
With regards to what arises. I don't know where I went with it, but it's something that's occurring right now, and with especially with the thread of why you're practicing what you're practicing, but and fighting against something at my workplace with somebody that's toxic, and several of us are going through it, but we've all made the same comment about, well, if I feel like I'm losing, if we don't fight, we're losing. That play of, and trying to stay with that feeling of loss, you're kind of between, like, where does that come from? What are you supposed to do with that?
Yeah, this is a very, you know, I can, you know, very compelling question. I can get a sense of that, but it's also a question that it's hard to like answer. Like, what's the right path there? I think, you know, a good rule of thumb is knowing yourself deeply is really always helpful. To notice, you know, how you're feeling, that sense of loss, that sense of losing, of the toxicity of the workplace and the difficulty of it. You know, to let that really be known, not to the point, though, that we become lost in it, that we lose our capacity to act. I think that's that kind of fine line, because sometimes we can just go into so much despair and hopelessness without this kind of the upwelling of how do we act. I think we spend so much time talking about connecting with the moment how it is, but we don't often talk about how that connection then becomes what we come out of. We come into wise action. It's like that connection, really acknowledging it. Then from there, we actually act. It's almost like a springboard that we come into wise action. And then how do we act in the world? I mean, there's so many things you have to navigate around the conditions, because some conditions are really difficult to navigate. You know, I don't know the situation or the difficulty, but, you know, sometimes there's the power dynamics, you know, the rules, the culture make things really hard to navigate, you know. And so then sometimes it's like, okay, maybe just listen to my own pain, listen to my coworker's pain, and see if we can get through this period. Or sometimes it's talking to the right person, or sometimes it's, you know, making a complaint or wherever it might be. But it's, unless we really connect with it, we won't be able to maybe see what the problem is. But again, some things I know are not really not very solvable. You know, it's not like it's a magical thinking. If you connect, then you're going to find the perfect solution. You know, sometimes it works that way, and sometimes you just realize this is very painful. And I think that's when I talked about winning and losing, I was thinking maybe I was talking, I know I heard myself saying that, but I forget the context. It might have been around just sometimes that's part of the company, or sometimes that's the dynamic, but just to realize sometimes there's that dynamic, but there's also what's really true for you in the midst of that. You know, what, another way to say it is, what's going to be stable and still here, even if you lose, even if you win. So I don't know if that's helpful at all, but it sounds like a challenging environment.
Being with loss, is trying to touch on that is hard.
So when you say loss in relationship to, is it around a work situation?
Mm-hmm.
So like a loss of a manager or a person or a...
No, walking away. Just walking away. Doing the healthy thing for yourself is the loss of not winning. That sense of feeling of, you know, everybody's saying the same thing and we're all on the same page, but that inner feeling of, if I leave now, one person I think very highly of, she said it, and she's like, if I feel now, I feel like I've lost to her.
Mm.
And I've been trying to kind of feel that, and it's this very interesting to feel loss in a battle. Like, it's hard to connect with that winning and losing. And I'm trying to, when you said the thread, I was trying to figure out how I could connect that with why I started in Buddhism. And it just seems to be too, I need to sit a little bit more with it.
Yeah. So with the, you know, maybe do some writing about it, and this is, you know, a cliche, but you know, there's the battle, but then there's the war. It's like, how can I you know, maybe they'll lose this one battle, but maybe the bigger picture, there can be a sense of winning or a sense of success. And sometimes it's reframing what is success, what is a positive outcome.
Right, right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yes. Can we get a mic for you so they can hear you online? Right here in second row.
So last week, I got in a really big fight with a friend that I have known for many, many years.
Yes.
And the source of the fight was like, I shared something with her, some feedback that I made the assumption because we had known each other for so long that I could share feedback with her in the way that I did with my family, which is normally just like pretty straightforward. And, but you know, there's no grudges or anything. It's just like, here's this information, you know? And she got very, very upset, and we ended up like meeting. She wanted to meet in person, and she got extremely defensive, and then she just left. And I felt, and like we haven't talked since, and I felt that I felt very upset because when I gave her that feedback, what I really wanted was her to see me, like to see my hurt emotion, you know? And I just felt like her reaction made it all about her ego, and I didn't feel seen at all. And then it sort of made me question the whole friendship and how deep it was. And also, I didn't feel like psychologically safe in the future to bring up something else if something else were to happen that I wanted to express my feeling about. And so I'm kind of in a quandary right now about how to go forward with it, but it's sort of about feedback. I know it's not about livelihood, but I thought maybe just as a microcosm, it could help us examine the nature of feedback.
Yeah, that's again sounds like a very painful experience, and you can, you know, sense all the hurt. You know, there's the hurt of you not being seen, not being acknowledged. There's the her reaction, her defensiveness, and however she took it. And that's, you know, if you kind of step back, you know, you said this, that your family of origin, this is a good way to offer feedback. It wasn't personal. People just take it. And her family is probably different, right? Yeah. And so part of it is kind of stepping back and noticing, you know, basically if it's a friendship, especially a long-term friendship, I think it's always good to try to repair that, to talk about it, to say, okay, you know, we had a really big, you know, hard conversation, and I want to hear what that was like for you. That's kind of the tricky point is, you know, and I think as meditators, we have a more well-trained mind and more capacity, hopefully, to hold our experience and to start by being the listener. Like, tell me about what that was like for you. You know, how did you hear that? Because I bet she heard it in a very different way than you intended it, right? She didn't understand that you were trying to share something, sounds like, more vulnerable about yourself, perhaps. You know, and then hopefully then you can share how you felt. And so you start to kind of come back to that sense of appreciation. Because friendships, relationships, a lot of the test is in these difficult times. You know, because if we get close to people, we're going to hurt each other occasionally. But how do we repair that? How do we listen? How do we actually grow closer through it? You know, the timing of it, I'm not sure when she'll be willing or when you'll feel willing. But trust that basically, essentially, it's just a different set of assumptions that came together and collided. That there's still your love for her. There's still your appreciation. There's still all your history with her. Not to throw all that out. Not to question that. Just realize you have to navigate how to share things. And in the future, you could ask her, you know, is it okay if I share some of these things? That's really important for me. And how can I say it in a way you could hear it? All right. No magic bullets, but it's anything else about that?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so I agree with you that like there's a different kind of conflict style maybe happening. But at the same time, what I'm trying to figure out is like, is it like so, like I think if the other person is very defensive and there's that pattern happening all the time, it can be more narcissistic and then it's not like a reciprocal, like if you don't feel safe just saying, giving basic feedback, is that a healthy relationship?
Well, that's a whole another, that's the thing to ponder. It's like, is there just this, it's not going to work out no matter what I do, or if it's always going to be, feel dangerous or feel scary to share that. You know, I tend to be kind of optimistic and sometimes I have to work with my disappointment or my sense of loss. Okay, this isn't going to work out. You have to kind of ponder that a little bit, kind of think about that. Look at the history of that. And is it just maybe you guys were not going into this territory until just now and you saw that? Maybe she was just having a really bad day. You know, that's also a possibility that, because all of us, you know, on a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being the most skillful way of receiving and opening, and sometimes 1, you know, some days are a 1 for me. And so it's not a good day to get feedback. Yeah, so. Yeah, just sit with it, open to it, and see what resonates over time. All right, so Claire, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Let me lower the hand. Okay. Sorry about my messy background. I haven't like bothered to download the blur thing. Anyway, so
it's okay. We wouldn't have noticed it except you told us to.
All right. So my question is about kind of along the line of dealing with difficult people. My question is about how to handle, so I'm dealing with a difficult family member, and fortunately I don't have to live with this person, but this person makes very erratic decisions that affect them in a really negative way. And this person doesn't like know how to stop making the bad decisions. And it also affects like other family members who live with them. And I've kind of been trying to handle this in a insight meditation kind of way, in terms of like, I've accepted that I can't do anything to change the person. But I guess my question is more along the lines of like, I still have a really hard time, you know, when I hear about the erratic decisions, you know, when the person makes them, I have a hard time not letting it really interfere with like my, I mean, it's probably impossible to do this entirely, but I have a hard time like not letting this person interfere with like my ability to get my work done or like function in my, you know, day-to-day existence, like even when I'm outside of the situation and knowing like I can't change what this person does, it's still like it'll throw off like my life for like several days at a time, just knowing what this person like knowing the bad decisions this person continues to make.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to like figure out how to handle that from like an insight meditation kind of way.
Sure.
So that's kind of my question. Yeah.
So just to make sure I understand. So when you hear about this person's decisions and how it creates difficulty, it kind of churns you up. So then in completely different, unrelated arenas, you're kind of like a little off balance. Is that kind of
right? Like I feel lost in the drama that this other person is creating, even though I'm not getting involved directly in it. It's still like a close family member, and it's like really stressful. So
So a few ways to work with it. You know, one is metta. So metta is, you know, that offering. It's really the intentionality, because we're basically trying to change the intentionality from, you know, basically a little bit of ill will toward this person toward one of like at least kindness, right? Mm-hmm. So kindness doesn't mean you endorse or approve of their actions, but you're kind of really working with your own mind around them. And you can also work with the people who are affected in the family around that person's decisions. Yeah, may you be safe and protected in the midst of this experience. So even though it's kind of seems hopeless, it starts to change your own internal relationship with it. So that can be a powerful way to practice with it. And so when your mind just starts to swirl on that, you start to just take a few minutes to offer metta. Okay, may I be safe? May I be protected? May you be safe? May you be protected? And that starts to change kind of the wiring or that intention from ill will to one of metta. Another way to practice with it is to give some space meditatively to actually experience it consciously. So this is a technique I heard from Ajahn Amaro, and I think he called it the sandwich technique. So let's say you have, we'll make the numbers easy. Let's say you're doing a 45-minute meditation, but whatever length of meditation, divide it in thirds, right? First third, you're just going to practice feeling the breath, feeling the body, really grounding. The middle third, you plop that person into the meditation. Okay, but you're doing it in a way not to get lost in the story around it, but feeling how the body and the emotions and the thoughts kind of all get, you know, churned up. So you're kind of building up this capacity to hold, you're holding it, and the last third, you come back out, feeling the body, feeling the breath. And what sometimes happens is it allows you to see it in a more full and clear way. And the third way I would suggest is this is more of a writing practice. So you can write out, I hate it when this person does this, all right, or something like that. And then you notice what your response is. Or maybe you say, okay, this person, maybe let's do it this way. This person did X, Y, and Z. And then notice what comes up and you write that out. And then you just keep repeating that same phrase and seeing a new question, seeing what else comes up. And you might start to see through the layers is like, okay, there's initial anger, there's the fear, and then maybe there's a deeper quality that comes up. You know, just I'm really worried about them, perhaps, till you start to feel something shift. Because basically when you're kind of spinning around emotionally and mentally, we're kind of at this level of kind of like a echo chamber and learning to feel the deeper elements underneath. So there's three things for you to play with.
Thanks.
Thank you, Claire. Good luck with that.
Thanks.
All right. A lot of difficulties. Yes, go ahead. Noah.
So very appropriate to my life that we're talking about work and the Dharma. I recently took on a new position in management. It's a new foray for me. And it's been very difficult. It's been very difficult just for the company, like, or just for like our like store itself. Like, it's just been a difficult time for most people, but it's been difficult for me personally as well. And it's kind of making me question whether or not it was the right choice at all for me, like to get involved in this and like kind of have to be like involved in this kind of conflict, this kind of self-perpetuating conflict, and try to, or there's like this odd determination to be able to handle it, like that I feel like I'll get so much growth out of it that it's making me, it's putting me in a position where I'm working towards something, like spiritually and professionally, and yet it's taking a lot out of me. And yeah, I just wonder.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So with a situation like that where it's kind of it's mixed, right? There's some stuff which is, if it was like 100% one way, then it'd be a no-brainer to leave. Or if it's 100% the other way, of course, I'm going to stay with that. But there's a lot of difficulty, a lot of challenges with it. There's an effect on your health and your stress load. So, yeah, whether it's is a good choice or not, how long have you been in that role?
Well, I was on medical leave for like 3 months, but if you count like just the time I've specifically been there in that role, it's like 6 months.
Do you have a mentor or anybody you can talk to about all this?
Sort of. I mean, kind of, there's a limit to how comfortable I feel like admitting things to this person, but
yeah, it gets tricky. Well, what I would suggest is, you know, and this is a fourth option from the last question, is, you know, have some friends that you can talk to who are not part of the company, not part of that arena, and just let yourself kind of talk it out and let them ask questions, and that you sometimes they will let you see things and reflect things in a way that you may not be able to see for yourself. Because sometimes I hear, like my wife started a very stressful job, and you know, a lot of days she came home thinking she wanted to just quit it. And it's like, okay, like, is it good to quit or should she persevere? You know, it's hard to tell for a while. But after, you know, after a year of that, the next year, it's already much better. You know, and so it's hard to see in the middle of it. Sometimes we don't have that perspective. So that's one way besides just working it solo is to, you know, draw upon Sangha, whether it's a Buddhist Sangha or just, you know, friends or family, people you trust, who you can kind of just share your experience. Because I get that, yeah, if you're talking to like a mentor or a supervisor, it gets a little tricky how forthcoming you can be. And then they might kind of reflect, say, well, it sounds like when you talk about this part, you know, I can see your excitement. And when you talk about this part, I can see your despair. And it seems like, you know, one is a little bit more heavy than the other one. Does that help a little bit?
Yes.
Yeah, just trying to get a broader perspective. Because we're in the middle of a struggle, whether it's interpersonal or like a work situation, we often don't see things very clearly, right? So how can we get more clarity? How can we see this more fully? And like the techniques like with the last question or talking with friends, you know, writing it out, ways to see it a little bit more objectively.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, in the back there, Ryan.
I noticed that, I mean, unsurprisingly, a number of people's sort of thoughts are around dealing with difficult people in workforce and sometimes, or in life in general, and sometimes it occurs to me that for me, some of this, the challenge I have with this sense of loss, the first question I really resonated with around the sense of like, well, if I step away, did this person win, right? Were they rewarded for their bad behavior? And so something I was wondering, I would love to hear a little bit more your perspective on is almost this sort of sense of attachment I have to this sense of justice. Or the injustice that's happening.
Yeah.
How do I let go of this sense of injustice? You know, this person's being rewarded because obviously we look around and see lots of people being rewarded regularly for really bad behavior. And so you can drive yourself crazy waiting for that, you know? So how does you know, or how does karma play into this? I'm just curious what some of your thoughts are there.
Well, karma is an easy answer, easy way out of the question, is that, you know, karma will eventually catch up. You know, how it may not be so clear in this lifetime or next lifetime how that is, but there will be, you know, cause and effect for that actions. You know, in terms of that sense, but, you know, outside of that, that's a little bit of a little abstract there sometimes, because karma is kind of like, you know, what goes around comes around. We'll just, you know, but sometimes that helps us kind of settle down a little bit. It's like, okay, it's outside of my territory. But I think more to the point is like, okay, that sense of if I give up, there's a sense of loss, that sense of letting them get away with it, the sense of righteousness. And that part is, I think it's helpful to really explore it a little bit more, because there's underneath all that, it's like basically what we're trying to do is see the difference between clarity versus like being invested in a view. Okay, my view is right. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes I felt like I was really right, but it turned out I was wrong. But before I realized I was wrong, I was like, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to go down screaming. But then I realized, oh, okay, it's something I didn't see. I didn't see the whole thing. So that's one way to play with it, is like maybe it's more nuanced than we think it is. You know, you can do the empathy piece. Like maybe there's a lot of suffering that's going on. And that's what I do a lot with some of the bigger characters you might have noticed in the news. It's just like there's a lot of suffering that's driving things, you know, and everything that some people try to do is not really addressing the core of that suffering, you know. And so that's shifting paradigms. It's shifting from me winning and me losing to realizing, well, there's just a lot of suffering here. And the way they're going is causing more suffering ultimately for themselves and for a lot of other people. And that's a different way of holding it than I want them to get punished for this or have consequences for that. And there's also the sometimes there's a kind of the courage to be willing to confront, to step forward and say, okay, this is not okay. You know, and where that line is something, it's an alive question for all of us. All right, thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Okay, we've come to our 9 o'clock hour, so I want to thank all those who offered questions. And one of the powers of Sangha is that when you share something difficult that's going in your life, and a lot of people, just to model how they shared it, they talked about it without having to go into a lot of the details. So there's a sense of kind of honoring the confidentiality and the situation, but still giving enough energy that you understood what was going on. And those who you shared, realizing that everyone who heard you, all the, you know, the 60, 70, 80 people in the room are going to help you hold that in some way. They heard your suffering. They're helping you hold that. It's not going to necessarily make it go away, but you're not alone. And that's part of that expanding the container. It's not just you. It's like, okay, the Sangha is helping me hold this. So thank you all for sharing. So next week on the on the 15th, we'll have a forgiveness ceremony. So it might be a good dovetail for some of us. Work with forgiveness. So Carrie and I will be leading that. And then Carrie is scheduled to be here on the 22nd, and I'll be back on the 29th. And yeah, take a look at the website. Sign up for the newsletter, the monthly newsletter, because that's how we really communicate all this stuff. Sometimes we have, every month we have a kind of upcoming events. We have a quarterly, more in-depth newsletter with articles. And sometimes we do little flashes of news. So it's a good thing to sign up if you're not signed up. All right. Any ride share? Anyone need a ride home? I remembered. Okay. Thank you all, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Sleep, rest well.